Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we look once again to China. A popular narrative is that it's all gone wrong, but we'll be digging deeper and asking what the critical problems are and what the future could hold. We'll assess the challenges confronting the country from overinvestment to demographic change and from slowdown to forced growth. First, this week, let's look at the issue of overinvestment. Now, this largely happened in response to the pressures of 2008. China took on lots of debt to invest in infrastructure, and while it might have seemed like a good idea at the time and building it was good for growth then, now much of it is not proving useful and the assets aren't necessarily making enough return to pay off the debts they took on. We spoke to Jeffrey Yu, ultra high net worth investment strategist for UBS Wealth Management, and asked him for an insight into the issue.
This is a big theme within markets, especially when people begin to look at how the central bank has been responding to weaker growth over the last few quarters, and why more aggressive monetary stimulus has not taken place. And one of the main pushbacks from the central bank was they do not want to introduce another big credit push akin to the $4 trillion push in 2009, because that led to a lot of overinvestment, excess capacity. I would say the steel sector is perhaps the best example. There's a big effort to reduce steel production capacity this year. So all in all, that is not a lever that they really want to pull for this time. And also, even if they do try to induce a credit stimulus and try to push the GDP growth towards rather high levels, they know that this is not conducive towards long-term rebalancing either. China needs to move away from investment growth towards consumption growth, and the authorities know that credit growth only supports investment growth or is highly skewed towards investment growth. So that is not the way forward for the country.
When it comes to overinvestment, there are serious questions dating back to 2006, according to Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue and a regular Monocle 24 contributor.
I think from around 2006, the Chinese knew that they were coming to the end of that catch-up stage of rapid economic growth, which is characteristically when you pour all the concrete, you build all the roads, you stimulate your economy, you do all that, and that's the investment-led model. And that's fine. Everybody did that, but it wears out. There comes a point when you've built all the infrastructure and the returns on the investment get very thin. So in around 2006, 2007, they began to say, OK, so what's the next phase? How do we get into the more advanced? How do we cut back on investment? How do we move towards a more consumption, higher value, more efficient economy? And then a couple of things happened, notably the financial crisis. And so as they were thinking about the kind of reforms that might have led to less investment, along comes the financial crisis. Exports fall off a cliff because the West is in crisis. And they, probably slightly in a panic, threw an enormous stimulus package at the Chinese economy. So $1 trillion goes in, and 70% of it is spent on shovel-ready projects, so infrastructure again. And that really was surplus to requirements. So then you get ghost cities, you get airports that are empty, you get roads that are going nowhere. There's no return on that.
Yifan Hu, Regional Chief Investment Officer of UBS Wealth Management China, begins her analysis of the issue in 2008.
If we look at the go back to 2008, actually it's a global stimulus. It's not only China. So I think at that time, yes, in China have a $4 trillion stimulus package. So I think that's mainly invested in four fields. I would think two fields could be regarded as successful, but two fields actually it's now bring some troubles to the economy currently. So I think relatively speaking, for the investment in the infrastructure and the high-speed railway actually really support the economy and also provide the driver for the continuous growth. So that's the good investment. But at the same time, I think because of the try to bail out the economy, especially among global recession, the Chinese government also promote for the real estate sectors. So make it now it's leading to lots of inventories. And also at the same time, I think they try to promote the car industry. So that's also another source currently for this kind of traffic, pollution, and also overcapacity of the steel industry.
Next on The Bulletin with UBS, we're talking about forced growth. Has the overproduction of things like steel to fulfil growth targets in the past now left the country, and global markets for that matter, oversupplied with big price declines and unprofitable factories? Well, there are certainly domestic and international aspects to this. Jeffrey Yu explains.
Well, two issues, one domestic and one internationally, right? So on the domestic side, you know, clearly a lot of these enterprises, you know, like steel, especially enterprises with overcapacity and heavy investment, where the state is actually disproportionately strong. You know, they face their own unique challenges, heavily subsidized, politically difficult to slim down, and especially, you know, shed jobs, for example. So, you know, that's going to be one of the biggest challenges for China, you know, during the process of reform. But they know that domestically, you know, this needs to change unless they start to produce, you know, zombie companies and, you know, throw good resources after bad, especially in an environment where resources in terms of fiscal space and credit space is actually starting to dwindle. You know, they want to allocate funding, you know, towards new initiatives, you know, innovation, you know, areas which boost consumption growth. So, you know, that is going to happen over the medium to longer term on a domestic basis. You know, how to find that right balance between incentivizing those strong growth at all costs, especially for local governments, you know, versus the national interest to rebalance. You know, that's something that the authorities have to address. I mean, internationally, you know, clearly China is starting to export deflation right now. I believe in a so PPI has been falling for 47 straight months, you know, something like that. And it's starting to have an impact globally, not just in steel, but other finished products as well. So that is probably more of an issue, you know, for, you know, international policymakers, you know, how they can manage that, how to, you know, harness, you know, lower input costs, which, you know, ultimately, you know, translate into, you know, greater savings of underlying consumers. But the problem for countries outside of China, I would say, is that even though underlying incomes are going up, you know, the U.S. being the best example here, people are not necessarily, you know, spending it. Corporates, you know, the input costs are coming down, but they're unwilling to raise their prices and they're just sitting on cash hoards.
We asked Yifan Hu, too, about forced growth.
In China, indeed, I think for the government supports is much more effective than the developed economies. It's mainly because its investment cycle, to some extent, is anti-cyclical because it's a major partly is driven by the government investment. So since China has in the past 30 years has been very two-digit growth, but I think if infrastructure actually has been greatly improved in the past 5 to 10 years, that's actually contributed to the government supports. So I think for this investment side, and as we said, for some sectors, probably I think it's needed by the economy. So it's we should see like provide positive power to the GDP growth. But also, of course, at the same time, for some industries, especially for some heavy industries, I think that China had a very quick, very rapid growth, especially during the global expansion. So after the financial crisis, I think with the global demand suddenly weakened. So I think that's actually become the overcapacity sectors. So I will not put the China case as it's kind of forced growth. I think it's because it expanded with the global economy, and then now it has to experience the very painful adjustment to the new normal of the global economy.
And what about some background here from the author, investor and analyst Bob Suara? Bob provides a considered take on the background to the current environment.
One could argue that in China, the Faustian bargain that the Chinese population signed with their government was we will suppress our wages in return for export-led growth. And as part of that, they also, by the way, dismantled the iron rice bowl. So you have a situation where a population was taking low wages, ended up with not really much of a safety net at all. You don't really have a family structure in the way that you have in India, perhaps, that might provide some other form of safety net. So actually now that the situation starts to change and you suddenly start having those people to consume more, I'm not sure they are capable of doing that, because actually they're worried about what the future is for them. The uncertainty actually now haunts them even more. So I don't see how, for example, they can take China into being consumer-led at all. And in fact, I think the Chinese government, one would argue, unless it recreates some element of social safety net, perhaps through bringing in health insurance, something like that, it still runs the risk of leaving them behind. And I think that same pattern gets repeated in many other countries in many different ways.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look at the demographic challenges shaping China now and in the years ahead. And we'll ask, is it actually better for the rest of the world if Chinese growth slows? So what are the key demographic challenges facing China? A popular thought might be that China is a very well-populated country, but its labour force is now shrinking, possibly as a result of the one-child policy of recent years. Here's Isabel Hilton again.
Well, it is a problem. And as you say, the one-child policy is a key factor here because in a characteristically, again, in an emerging economy, we look at India, you've got a lot of very young people. And that's essentially you've got a lot of people on the land. So you take those people, it's a low-wage economy, they're pleased to catch up because they're earning cash, everybody's getting somewhere. But there comes a point when, as their wages rise, you lose that particular competitive advantage, which is why you have to go up the value chain. Now, in China, that was compounded. They did move an awful lot of people off the land. It's now predominantly an urban society. But because of the one-child policy, they have an inverted triangle of a population. They're not sitting on a broad base of workers. They've got an awful lot of retired workers and more retired workers who are sitting on top of a rapidly narrowing base of people engaged in productive activity. So that has other knock-on effects, enormous healthcare implications, and China doesn't have a universal healthcare system and hasn't had since the 70s. Pensions, you know, who's going to support, who's going to pay the pensions? And labour itself is now really getting quite scarce. So what are those people going to do? They're not all necessarily skilled in a way that a more advanced economy would require.
Jeffrey Yu, meanwhile, cites an old adage when it comes to reading the delicate demographic balance.
You don't want the country to become old before it gets rich, and that's really what China's facing right now. Again, it's a controversial issue, but the one-child policy has finally been lifted. But what you're seeing is, you know, this classical situation facing developed nations, and which is particularly acute in Asia, I must say. If you look at birth rates and total fertility rates in places like Singapore, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, where even, you know, with strong growth and rising incomes, there's, you know, not really, you know, any demand on the part of urban households to actually have more children. So the abolition of the one-child policy is an important component, but nowhere near enough. Again, going back to the rebalancing story, they need to establish a more comprehensive social security framework, a whole pension framework, you know, not just basically rely on kids to take care of their parents and for grandparents to serve as unofficial childcare, right? If we compare childcare in China versus childcare in other OECD countries, especially in Europe, I mean, the costs, you know, even translated in dollar terms, actually the gap is so wide, you know, such that normal households, you know, can only rely on grandparents, and this just reduces incentives, you know, for birth rates to go up. So, you know, this requires a lot of, not just, you know, political maneuvering, but also, you know, to change cultural perceptions as well.
And how would Yifan Hu sum up the demographic challenges?
There's two parts. First, I think there's for the China, the society is also getting old. So before we get rich, we're getting old first. So I think that's one challenging, the aging society. The second, I think it's also because for the China, active population actually will peak in 2015, according to the estimate of the United Nations. So that's partly attributed to the one-child policy. So I think this policy has been reviewed and revised since last year. So hopefully, I think after 10 to 15 years, hopefully for the China's labor structure probably will be renewed to some extent.
Finally, on today's programme, we return to the key question of growth. China obviously can't grow as fast nowadays, so is a slowdown not necessarily a terrible thing for the rest of the world? In fact, is it actually better if China grows more slowly and invests productively than grows quickly by investing in unproductive assets? Well, maybe, explains Jeff Yu, but how do you actually go about slowing down?
China's original intention was for investment growth and consumption growth to remain at relatively robust levels, but just as long as you make sure consumption growth grows at a higher pace than investment growth, then your economy can rebalance. But, you know, just as a thought experiment, let's say China's in recession, but still, if let's say China's in recession, consumption declines are at 1%, but investment declines are at 10%, that's still rebalancing, and in terms of shares of GDP, that means your consumption growth is going to rise, but it's going to be an extremely painful form of rebalancing, right? So the answer to this question is, you know, yes, slower growth is good, but, you know, what is the pain on the back of it, especially in terms of unemployment, you know, social stability, you know, these are the things that Beijing looks at the end of the day. So find the right balance there, I think, is you know, still work in progress, but time is, you know, running out. So again, going back to our earlier discussion, what limited resources may have left, and must make sure resources are invested, you know, adequately, you know, into areas which promote rebalancing and not at a high cost to employment and social stability.
Isabel Hilton, meanwhile, suggests that, yes, it could indeed be positive for the rest of the world.
It should be a good news story because, you know, this was meant to be a planned transition. The difficulty is that the transition requires the things that were promised in the third plenum, which included, you know, greater role of the markets, you know, all those disciplinary forces on an economy which do result in a more efficient and effective and higher value economy. And when they were tried, the party kind of panicked because, of course, the more you trust the market, the more you're at the mercy of events, and the party doesn't like being at the mercy of events. So they stimulate the stock exchange, they stimulate the stock market because the property market has kind of collapsed. They encourage people to put their money into the stock market in order to fund the new generation of enterprises that are going to come up. They create an enormous asset bubble, which then collapses. Now, the growth in that stock market was probably about 1% of the headline growth last year. So the other problem is 6-7%, which is what they said they, you know, that was the target. And, oh gosh, isn't it wonderful they hit it? Very few people think they grew at 6% last year. It's more like 4, 4.5. And that's quite worrying because you do need a certain momentum, you know, to carry you over this very tricky period. And not every country makes it through the middle income trap. In fact, most don't. So the worry for China now is stagnation. The worry for China's commodity suppliers is they've fallen off the cliff already. They're really hurting. Brazil, Australia, you know, the countries that depended on the China boom or had enjoyed the China boom. But for China itself, the risk is really more stagnation and discontent.
And a last word this week to Yifan Hu.
I think that, yes, the China slowdown is inevitable, and also it's good. I think it's a healthy slowdown. If we look at China, I think now China is the second largest GDP country and also have the two-digit growth for the past 30 years. So I think it's inevitably like a slowdown, and because China cannot grow at the previous model at the cost of the environment and pollution and also high inputs. So it should be more productivity-driven and technology-driven growth. So that also could be more healthy for the rest of the world. And the second I want to say, China now is very large. I think its spillover effect, actually, it could be larger than expected. So currently, I think it's before people always think China spillover effect normally focus on for the real economy in the trade. But now it looks like with China's like a very the increasing size of the asset size, I think that it also have more and more spillover effect in the capital market. So I think that definitely the China slowdown is painful for China, painful for the rest of the world, but I think it's actually the positive and healthy for the whole world in the longer term.
And that's Yifan Hu bringing us to the end of this 72nd edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Much of interest in next week's show, interest rates, will be in the spotlight. Listen again and find out more via the usual channels. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.